Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be visiting painting conservator Simon Gillespie for a poke around his studio. There will be masters.
Then we'll be discussing the creation of one of the world's most essential pieces of tech, GPS, with its very inventors.
And we'll be hearing from Pelling Opchin, director of London's venerable jazz festival.
That is all coming up, plus Monocle's Ben Ryan will be looking ahead to next week's news. And enjoy some music too. That's right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Very lovely to be showing a tropical studio with you.
You know that I'm loving this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to fill the listeners in. I think people at home know that you are a stylish gentleman and a man who quite likes a loud colour.
I do.
I know you've just come back from holiday in Brazil. I think you've brought a bit of it back with you. Talk us through the shirt. I love it.
It's kind of a lemon tree shirt with like big prints from Jacquemus. I mean, it's from the summer collection, but I like wearing summer collections in winter. That's my tip. I don't like winter clothes.
Well,
I have to be really honest.
It's cheering me up. I've had to strip off, but I'm very navy in here today. You're cheering everyone up.
But by the way, I was in my hometown, São Paulo, of course. It's almost summer there, but to be honest, it was quite cloudy, rain. It was about 20 degrees. It wasn't really tropical paradise. I did enjoy going home, though.
Okay, I like it. So what happens when you go home for a very short amount of time? It's very far away. What's wet weather fun in São Paulo? I mean, obviously, it's family and all the rest of it, but what can people do? Because people might be also thinking of booking holidays. They think of Brazil as a place of constant... I mean, there is a rainforest, so people should not be surprised, perhaps. But
there's lots of rain.
What does a local do in São Paulo on a rainy day?
You know what? I mean, if it's raining, the best place to be in Brazil is São Paulo, actually, because at least we have good restaurants, you know, good shops to go. So especially good restaurants, I have to say, because I was there to see my family. I mean, I ate, of course, amazing steak, amazing bread, you know. And
nice. There's
a restaurant there, if the listeners are listening, called Capim Santo. It's just brilliant.
Capim Santo.
I mean, there's an outside area which
it
I didn't go
to. It sounds delicious as well.
You come with me, Rob,
I will.
Next time.
Did you
have a good week?
I've had an okay week, but I've been a bit throaty. I was in the sick bay. I was working out of Monocle's Blackheath Bureau for a couple of days at the beginning of this week. But all is fine and dandy. And thanks for turning the aircon up. I think Maylie Evans there is in charge of the aircon, is in charge of everything else on this programme behind the glass. It is a tropical, 36 degrees in here, Faye, do you think?
Probably, actually.
It's basically, you brought a bit
sweating.
Of São Paulo home
we're
with
sweating.
You.
Or a little bit of Australia.
Yes, exactly. Is that a hint to our next guest? I believe it's his inaugural news look ahead. Let's get Ben Ryland in the studio.
Ben, the two of us need look no more. We both found what we were looking for.
Ah, it's a heartbreaking rendition of a beautiful song. Ben Ryland. Who else could it be? Welcome to the programme.
Oh, thank you very much. What a beautiful song to welcome me into the studio. I do appreciate that.
Do you know that song is about a rat, a pet rat? I'm sure that song, and I wanted to say this when you were in the studio rather than before we turned on the microphones, before we played the track. I'm sure that song is about Michael Jackson's pet rat when he was a child.
It has been run by me before, so I
think someone will write in, we can safely say. But it doesn't make any difference to the song. It's a wonderful piece of work.
It's a beautiful piece of work, probably a beautiful rat as well.
Who knows? Exactly. Okay. I don't know how long we can slide down that slithery tail of that rat before we end up at next week's news. What's it going to be, Ben?
In Australia, my homeland, there's been this big survey that's been happening. The ABC have been asking everyone quite personal questions, I must say. It's an anonymous survey, thank goodness. I took it a little bit earlier. And the idea
I've seen
of the survey...
I've seen your answers, it's fine, yeah.
Oh, how rude. The idea of the survey is to determine what the modern Australian character is. Now, what is the Australian character? I don't really know. As an Australian, I know what people mean when they say, oh, that's un-Australian. You know, it's one of the deepest insults you can get.
Yeah.
And it's usually levelled at politicians for doing something that's, you know, not really un-Australian at all.
How do you mean? Like lying or defrauding someone? Or
maybe someone came up with, I don't know, a silly idea like a carbon tax or something, and then someone might say, oh, that Julia Gillard, she's un-Australian charging the
So it's the idea of Australianness is it still that kind of old-fashioned, slightly macho? It's straight, white, and macho.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. If anyone who's seen a typical Australian movie, Crocodile Dundee or The Castle, I mean, this is the old-fashioned notion of what it means to be Australian.
Yeah. And well, see, as an English cricket fan, I kind of missed the days of Merv Hughes and knowing exactly everyone knew what side of the bread their butter lay on, kind of thing.
I shared a glass of wine with Merv Hughes once. That's a story for another day.
Oh, man.
Well, what's the most Australian thing about you? Because I know you don't like the cliches.
I've just answered all the questions in this survey, and I still don't actually know what is the most Australian thing about me. It's not even my accent, because I do get a lot of Australians asking me where I'm from. This is what's so perplexing, because I think the Australian culture is so young. You can speak to a lot of older Australians and they will say, this is what it was like in the good old days. But then you speak to young Australians and they have a completely different perspective on what the Australian character is. And we even have different ways of talking. And I think even our accents have changed over time. We've got a metropolitan accent and then a rural accent. And the rural accent sometimes can be a little bit Kath and Kim at times.
Are we effluent? So can you give us a couple of sample questions from the survey? A couple of the more pointed questions, perhaps, for Faye and I.
I've got my findings here. The questions, you'll have to take the survey yourself. And okay. I will add that it is open to anyone. It might skew the results if you start taking it all over the world.
Yeah. So perhaps... Or the Brazilians and Brits answering.
So it turns out the Brazilians are more Australian than the Australians.
So it turns out that I'm more of a people person because I prefer to spend time with actual friends rather than my pets. So that's probably good news for me. I'm less familiar with my neighbours than most Aussies, apparently.
I thought all Australians were obsessed with their neighbours, or is it just English people?
I think they're obsessed with neighbours, the soap opera.
That'll be me then.
I was quite honest and said I don't actually know the name of any of my neighbours. I've never met them. Maybe that's a bit sad. I do live in an apartment building.
But then in Australian sense, they probably think you're living in the outback and your next door neighbour's 500 miles away across down a dusty road. That's what it's expecting. So you're becoming less Australian, you think? You're diminishing from the stereotype.
Well, I have been here 6 years now, Rob. Yeah. So I'm becoming more British, I think. Which I suppose maybe that's a good thing.
Far be it for me to judge.
Far be it for you to judge.
I like Australians of all stripes. I'm a fan.
Thanks, Rob.
So after Monday, it must be Sunday?
We're actually skipping over to Friday now.
Okay.
Because on Friday, we're in for a bit of a treat. If you are like me and a fan of, shall we say, slightly unfashionable music, Robbie Williams is going to be dropping a Christmas album.
Oh, yeah.
Believe it or not, it is his first Christmas album ever, which did surprise me. I thought he would have jumped in that bucket by now. But no, it's a mixture of covers. There are a few original tracks on there. There is one called Rudolph, which has a bit of a sample from Carols of the Bells in it.
Nice.
So it is quite nice that it manages to feel familiar whilst also being a brand new song. And you've got to hand it to Robbie. I think there was a little bit of a phase where he was trying very, very desperately to hang on to the old days of when he was a real big mega pop star, sort of one of the last pop stars, I suppose, we had before online took over and sort of ruined the notion in some ways of what a mega pop star really is. But he does seem to have matured with his fans. He knows exactly who's buying his records. Yeah. I think a record executive years ago said Robbie's popular with the grannies, girlies and gays. That's who buys his music. And, you know, that's still true now, isn't it?
I love Robbie. He's a born pop star.
I think it's going to sell well. Robbie Williams in Christmas sounds like a good idea in 2019. In some
ways. Well, I mean, Fernando, in his own words, Robbie says he's hoping to knock Michael Bublé off his perch. Mm. Look, nothing wrong with Bublé, but it's about time, right?
I do miss his Root Box phase, though. It was one of my favourites. It was a bit of a flop, I know.
It was. I don't think anyone misses that Root Box phase.
I kind of like his sort of imperial period of his first couple of albums. It was great. All the songs on it were good. He was cheeky, but I kind of like him as he's got old. He's still a handsome man. He's aged pretty well.
Absolutely.
And as you said when you were prepping us up for your topics, I'm amazed that he hasn't done a Christmas album before. It seems like absolutely his natural habitat. I mean, he's done a crooner album, hasn't he?
He's done quite a few of them, actually.
Standards record, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
It's good stuff. Yeah, it's a bit of cheese, come on.
Bit of cheese. Well, you could almost credit him with bringing back this idea of the crooner's album. So, you know, Bublé might actually owe a lot of his career to Robbie stepping out first and doing that Swing When You're Winning album all those years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Ben, what a wonderful maiden voyage on HMS News Look Ahead. Should we sound the foghorn, Faye?
Absolutely. Thank you, Ben. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly, and in a moment we'll be hearing from Simon Gillespie.
For over 40 years, painting conservator Simon Gillespie has plied his trade on some of the world's most important artworks. From old masters to upstart geniuses, his canvases, canvases, all of them.
He welcomed Monaco's Agostino Macellari to his central London studio amongst extraordinary array of artwork from Caravaggio to Coase. He explained where patina ends and dirt begins, and just what it's like getting your hands on the world's greatest paintings.
I am Simon Gillespie. I've been restoring paintings for 40 years now. Over that time, I've built up the most extraordinary collection of collectors and people who are interested in buying works of art. And so we advise, and then we normally get involved in conserving and restoring, two different things. And yeah, we're surrounded by all sorts of, as we sit here, we're surrounded with contemporary works, and then behind us a Tiepolo, and there's a Caravaggio in the other room down there, and we have a mini museum. My insurance company throw fits when sometimes when I phone them up and say what I've got.
As you say, you've been at it for 40 years. That's enough time to have seen the art landscape change quite considerably. I imagine that when you started, the business was largely centered around more classical works. And obviously now, you know, in the entrance hall, we've seen a Coase, which maybe isn't the loveliest painting here, but is still quite remarkable. You said that you have a Banksy knocking around. There's a demand for people to pay attention to newer works. How have you incorporated that into your sort of practice as a conservator?
As a conservator, I will advise anybody who wants to get involved with anything to do with paint, whether it's a painted sculpture, whether it's a contemporary sticky painting which is still wet, or whether it's a 600-year-old piece of gold ground altarpiece. We will advise and then carry out the work on it. And having that cross the centuries' ability to look at these works of art, it's actually fascinating. Every day we've got a different thing to research and then carry out. And I love that aspect of it, thinking what it is that we're going to do today. Have we got to find the right gold to match the gold on these paintings, or have we got to find the right sort of diamond glitter to go on a glitter painting, which is right here? If you get the wrong diamonds, it's going to show. Silly things like that. So we have to make up models sometimes to see whether the colours are going to be the same. One of the worst things I get is, which is the Banksy we've got here at the moment, which is a white painting. A white painting on canvas are the worst, you know, because the canvases these days are so perfectly made. Every little tiny knot is perfect. And then you put on these perfect white, luminous white paints on top of it. And if you get a rip in something like that, it's a nightmare. It's one of the worst things that you can possibly want to restore. But we do occasionally get that sort of thing. This Banksy has got handprints all over it, which instantly happen because we think that we've just washed our hands and they're nice and clean. But lo and behold, they're not. They've got this sort of wonderful oily substance that keeps the extraterrestrial bugs away from us. Once that goes onto a white painting, it's there forever. And actually on a contemporary acrylic painting, you'll find that the paint actually absorbs it and then sucks in the dirt as well, and it becomes uncleanable. So Banksy's now got handprints forever.
I suppose that when you're engaging with a Banksy versus when you're dealing with a Caravaggio, you have a very different set of aims. You know, your approach must differ in that with a Banksy, presumably you're not looking to maintain any of its sense of the passage of time. You're trying to restore it to something that approximates or even is a condition that it left the studio in. Whereas a Caravaggio, perhaps, you're not trying to make it look new. And I wondered how you approach time and are respectful of this kind of patina. Where does the dirt end and the patina begin?
It's a very good question. Interference in art, where is that grey line? Interference from all sorts of different things, including patina, dirt, let's call it patina. We don't really expect to find a Caravaggio looking as if it's come straight out of the studio. That would be ridiculous. Some people do, in the old days, would have wanted that. And in the 19th century, it was a prerequisite. Everything had to look absolutely good. Everything now that is modern, including things going back to Andy Warhol, have to be 100%. If they're not, then it has an impact on the price, an impact on the desirability, because there are enough of them around that you can actually go and get another one, which is perfect. If your Lucien Freud has got a small scratch on it, it will have an effect on the price. if you look at a picture under an ultraviolet light and you see it's been interfered with by somebody like me, then it will have an effect on the price. Therefore, yes, there is a desirability to have perfect objects. There is this strive, there is this work to actually try and make things look good. Caravaggio here will have a wonderful patina, rather like an old table with water rings on it, same sort of thing there. Old portraits, sometimes the family will come along and actually upgrade the medals that that guy won back in, you know, in the day. I'm not saying from having tight trousers to flares or anything like that, but that sort of thing does happen. And then, yes, you've got people interfering with pictures of backgrounds. I mean, there's a famous dealer back in the turn of last century, Duveen, who dealt with some of the best objects, and they've all shunted over to America, once asked why his pictures were all very shiny. And he answered, well, my rich clients like to be able to see themselves at the same time as viewing their works of art. Shiny varnishes are out now.
I suppose it also kind of comes back a bit to how we as a culture engage with ideas of authenticity and what that means. And part of your job, as you say, is not only to do this work, but to camouflage your presence, to conceal the fact that you were ever there, because to participate in the kind of life of this painting is to, in some way, affect the authenticity of the artist's intent. I've read interesting things about in the Far East, for example, where ideas of authenticity and originality are not quite so tightly bound in to an object, and a temple can be the same temple having been demolished and rebuilt several times according to the same principles. And I wondered if your clients have differing expectations in that regard, or if when it comes to this sort of painting that you're restoring, there's people have broadly similar expectations.
I spend a lot of my time educating the owner of paintings, going from that 19th century view that everything has to be 100% perfect, and explaining that everything old will acquire a patina, whether it is dirt, staining, or cracking. We don't have to take all those cracks out. You know, we are falling apart as much as the painting is falling apart. We get older and become more cracky. So it's one of those things, I think, that we are now, the restorer, the conservator now has enough influence in the art world that we can actually say, leave it alone. It doesn't need to be done. I love this business because it's dealing with cultural objects that we can actually literally pick up. We can't go and do that in a museum. We can't go and tap it and see whether it's in good condition or not. We can literally pick it up. I love this. You know, that's what I do. And I love to try and impart that to the collector. He's got to really enjoy it as well. And some of my collectors are really interested in the nitty-gritty of what we do and also what they've got as well. And are interested to look after it.
That must be the best type of client, someone who isn't just buying something as an asset, someone who's buying it out of passion, out of engagement.
There are a number of very, very passionate clients, and those are my best people. I just love when they've actually said, Simon, I'm bringing in another picture today, and I've just bought this. And you look it up, see what they bought, you think, my God, that's going to go really well in your collection, well done. And then you do get the other guys, which is rather sad, you know, Simon, I've just bought six pictures, they've all gone into storage, we'd like to go and check them every year. I'm never going to have them at home.
Let's not even go there. You kind of just answered this in a way, or you brought it up, but I'm very interested in how having a tactile relationship with these objects, as you say, you can go to the British Museum every now and then and there'll be a lump of ancient Assyrian rock that someone will let you pick up under supervision. Unbelievably privileged a position to be in, and I'm sure well-deserved as well because it's your profession, but how does that change your relationship with objects of art?
I'll tell you one rather lovely, which still brings up the hair on the back of my neck. I normally work by myself in the evening or early in the morning when everybody else has gone home and phone stops ringing. And with a nice glass of wine and a nice piece of music, you can just get on with just doing the final touches without being interfered with. There was one painting, it was a self-portrait of Franz Hals, and I was doing the finishing touches one evening, and it wasn't much to do, but I was totally engaged with him, sitting, looking at him straight in the eyes, looking at his highlights, doing exactly the same movements that he would have been doing, and placing the tiny little dots of paint that were missing on that picture back in, physically doing what he was doing. And I thought I was only there for about half an hour. My wife phoned me up, and it was 12:30, and said, where the hell are you? It was the closest thing to time travel. I knew he was sitting on my shoulder, guiding me what to do. And it was just a relationship we had that evening with Franz Hals. It was the most wonderful piece of cultural exchange over time. It's an honour.
Can we have a look at something and you can tell me a bit about how you've kind of gone about it?
Well, this is a picture that's just come in. And in fact, the client was here this morning looking at this. He's bought four new paintings for a rather wonderful collection he's got in South London. And this is a view of Thames. And funny enough, he's got another painting from the same artist, which actually could have been the other half of this painting. But views of Thames, you'd get it, one artist would paint both banks all the way down. So we've got a view here looking towards St. Paul's Cathedral, and this has got the typical expanse of water and lots of people on the water using the river, and then the sky, which covers two-thirds of the picture, which is all new clouds and new blue paint, or greeny paint, because it's got yellow varnish on there as well. Now, we're just carrying out a test on this, and it's very interesting to see it all being exposed. The whole of the sky has been repainted. And interestingly, somebody who repainted it is an artist, and somebody has painted on thick clouds with heavy brushstrokes, impasto, and then he must have put it in the oven to crack it, to make the paint dry and cause all these deep black cracks in the painting. Luckily, it hasn't destroyed the painting underneath, but what is appearing through this test that we've now carried out, which is about 4 inches wide, is another cloud, nice white cloud with original cracks and a little bit of patina on the surface. It's a bingo. We've won. It's going to be okay, isn't it?
It's quite lovely having that little... I mean, it peeps through. It's kind of in the middle of the sky section of the painting, and it's suddenly much clearer. As you say, there's a yellow tinge to the upper two-thirds where the sky is. But I suppose what this can't tell you is, can you get any indication of exactly when this might have happened? And I suppose it can't tell you why someone did that. You know, who would overpaint a painting like this?
Why would anybody paint over something like this? At the moment, it looks like there's a perfectly good picture underneath. But my second motto in life is there's always a reason why, especially as a restorer. I will wait with tension to find out whether there's a lot of damage underneath this. There are some deep cracks that have been painted out as well, so maybe that's the reason. But that, you know, cracks these days, people accept cracks in paintings. They're old, like us. We all crack up.
This is it, entropy versus interference.
Yeah, and what's appearing there is wonderful. It's great. So, you know, we were a bit nervous this morning when we were showing the client. We had one blue patch which looked like it had been painted appearing from underneath the yellow sky, which looked like it was modern dye, but in fact it actually works very well. So, yeah, we're pleased with that.
So now we're looking at a Chagall in a kind of large frame. It's sitting on its own on a easel here in the corner of the studio.
So this is literally coming again in the last 2 or 3 days, and it's come from a private collector in England, and she wants to know what the condition is like and actually wants to take off this rather shiny varnish that's been put on it recently. When I say recently, the last 20 years. I've inspected it with ultraviolet light and also with strong torches and things to get reflections to come off it. And what we can find here is that the painting has been expanded around the edge by about an inch, and in order to get more square inches to sell, I suppose. But it's got very strange texturing where it's been expanded. And the retouching on it is pretty muddy. And the varnish, as I say, is very shiny and slick and doesn't look very good at all. A picture like this should have a slightly dull, dusty appearance.
Yes, it's strange looking at it, standing slightly to the side. You almost can't see the painting at all, can you, for the reflection? And it really throws up the texture of the canvas as well.
So we've done a tiny little test on one of the figures here, which shows that the yellow varnish, when it's removed, would produce a 50% brighter image underneath. It's interesting the way this painting's been painted. The artist has actually used a very coarse jute canvas, which is very open weave, and he hasn't put any preparation there on it at all. So it's showing all the knots of the canvas and the weave of the canvas. This is quite typical of him at this period. We're talking about when he was still in Russia, using poor materials. It's the part of his work that actually is more sought after, because it was when he was emerging as a really interesting artist.
How long would you expect to spend with a painting like this? How long will it take before it's back with the collector?
She wants it back quite quickly. It's a picture that is quite close to her heart. She wants it back quite quickly. So I'm going to assume about 3 months. But there are two things we can do to this. We can simply just dull down the varnish on it by putting only yet another duller varnish on top, which won't really make it 100% better. But what we could do is to remove this varnish and take off the old dirt that's been grained in the paint and actually reveal the original colours, which will have a patina of age, some cracking, a little bit of old green ingrained dirt, but it'll look at least 50% brighter, and there'll be much more volume in the objects in the composition. That's what's so lacking sometimes when pictures get dirty and the varnishes become yellow and dull and flat. You lose dimension in the picture.
There are obviously, you know, you have this very, very broad range of techniques. I imagine a lot of research must go into safely restoring paintings, especially when, you know, there are uncertain materials involved, things are volatile. How much do you, as a studio, experiment? How much research have you kind of incorporated and put back out into the industry? Is that a thing that you would expect to do, or are other people doing that and you're kind of taking that training from them?
We normally rob everybody else's experimentation. We can't really afford to do all of the scientific experiments to make new varnishes, make new glues and all that sort of thing. So we're robbing the ideas from the international universities. And they don't mind that. They're working in the universities like the Courtauld to experiment and to come up with these new ideas. But what I do say is that we've taken on, everybody here in the studio is highly trained and has huge experience, because we have a huge volume of work that comes through here. And we're right at the peak of the industry of conservation, using the most up-to-date methods, which are indeed the safest methods now of cleaning that have ever been in time. Gone are the days of using petrol derivatives and sloshing on to pictures and then just watching the thing expand and whatever came off, you know. That's long gone now, thank God. The materials we use now are very small percentages of volatile solvents suspended on the surface of the picture, and we can tailor-make these solutions for the precise problem.
Thanks to Simon Gillespie in conversation with Monaco's Augustin Macellari. And if you'd like to see more of what Simon does, and you are in the UK, you can watch him at work in Britain's Lost Masterpieces, available on BBC iPlayer now. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly here on Monaco 24. Rob, I think it's time for some music.
Definitely time for some music, Faye.
This time I decided to pick up some French electro, which I love. It's this artist. His name is French79. The song is Hometown.
Nice one, Faye. That was Hometown by French79. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Up next, set a course for insights into GPS from two pioneers of the technology. Do stay tuned.
Here in The Weekly, we like to think we're pretty good at capturing a sense of place in audio. But next, we're going to hear from a couple of very, very clever chaps who have gone much further than that. Bradford Parkinson and Hugo Fruhoff are two of the fathers of GPS, the global positioning system that uses satellites to deliver time and a geolocation data to enable devices anywhere on Earth. In short, this is the tech that means you can always find where you are on your smartphone and how your in-car sat-nav can guide you to your destination.
Bradford and Hugo, alongside Richard Schwartz and Professor James Spilker, are the recipients of this year's Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering for their work on developing GPS, a prestigious accolade that recognises their contribution in creating a technology that has transformed lives, industries and much, much more. Tom Edwards tracked them down to a radio studio on the campus at Stanford University to ask them about their work.
Brad, perhaps I can come to you first of all. I guess one of the reasons that we're speaking to you both is you're the recipients, along with some others, of the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering. Not an accolade that's given out lightly, and a measure, I guess, just one small measure of the significance of your achievements. Tell us a bit about the origin story of the first great achievement. If we look back to the origin story of GPS, was it a story of collaboration, of coming together, cooperation around the world? Often these great achievements are the result of exactly that.
In this case, I wouldn't describe that in that way. Certainly the applications of today are collaborations, but In the very early days, there were two competing concepts within the Department of Defense, and like all things that are competing, they were at each other's throats, and I was brought in. I had the right technical background, in-depth knowledge of astrodynamics and control theory and things like that. And I was brought in to try to sort things out. And it turns out the first time I tried to gain approval for a demonstration at the Pentagon, I was turned down. At the time, I was an Air Force colonel, rather unique. I had a PhD from Stanford and a master's from MIT. So having failed, I called a meeting, and I did it about 2,000 miles away from home base because I wanted to take a fresh look. And we had only Air Force officers except for two civilians in that meeting. And the Air Force officers were individuals I'd hired, all with advanced degrees, a very, very bright bunch of people. And over a long weekend, we have a holiday here called Labor Day. Over that long weekend, we redid the system. We made a lot of modifications and came up with a 7-page document that described it. And then the fun began because I ended up having to fly back and forth across the coast, from one coast to the other, over the next 90 days or so. And finally, in December of 1973, I gained approval to put together a demonstration system. And the claim that I had made is that we could get 10 meters from space, from ranging to these satellites that were three continents away. There were a lot of doubters, but sure enough, about 4 years later, I finally was able to show everyone that with our extensive testing, we had indeed done that. And along the way, I was launch commander for some satellite launches and this and that. But by and large, it's a story of cooperation, engineering, intense engineering, and a fair amount of fortune because, frankly, the Air Force did not want this system at all. If we had stumbled in the least, I'm afraid they would have canceled us.
And Hugo, if I can jump to you, I wonder, I presume that you sort of recognize that origin story. And it strikes me as interesting, often speaking to people who are behind the devising of real great leaps forward, that they are often met with doubt in many quarters, and often they are compelled to overcome failure along the way. And it's a truism, I suppose. And I wondered if this resonates with you, that maybe you learn more when times are hard, when you're doubted, in fact, when you're faced with failures, than almost when things go right.
Well, I certainly wasn't part of the early story. I was fortunate enough to come in towards the end, where Rad and others would start first with RFIs, request for proposal for information. And those RFIs began to circle around the major aerospace industries who were capable to build such a system. And then you begin to sort of technically leveling. So you kind of get involved in it for a whole year, this. And then possibly at some point when the government is comfortable enough that people really understand where we're going with all this, then finally a request for a proposal comes out, and then you spend another year addressing that proposal. So you do all your homework, not only just writing the proposal, but building equipment, testing equipment. And most of that is usually done with funds from the companies that plan to win this and obviously are able then to recoup their losses. Sometimes you also get money to do the proposal to some extent. And this is where we came in at Rockwell International at the time in Seal Beach, California, and began to address what Brad and his team had put into the proposal. So for us, it was, you know, Brad is the guy that suffered in the beginning. For us, it was just nothing but great fun.
And Brad, if I can return to you, tell me a little bit about the scale of the ambition. I mean, you've painted that picture already, hugely ambitious. And it sounds like you did have quite a clear view in mind about how you wanted to proceed. I wonder, though, if we look at what GPS has become, what it's afforded, the changes, the differences that it's made all around the world, could you have envisaged the scale of the impact it would have?
I think the answer, crisp answer, is no. I had a bunch of charts that I had hand-drawn that showed how we would use it. And I'm talking both on the military side, but principally on the civilian side. A lot of people say, no, it's a military system that much later the civilians were allowed to use. That's not true. So from the get-go, I described to the United States Congress, I testified and told them that there would be an at-risk signal, but a civilian should be able to get some pretty good accuracy. But a couple of things happened along the way that were enablers. They were engineering enablers. The first is that the cost of a receiver, which originally had been $250,000, over the last 30 years is now about $1.50. That changes a lot of things in terms of what's available and how we use it. The other thing was the engineers had gone to work, and that we knew there was a way to get very, very precise positioning, but I did not think it was very robust. I didn't think it was reliable. Well, they made it reliable. So today, a really good receiver controlling a farm tractor in England will get accuracies down on the order of a couple of centimeters. Consistently, very robustly, and in the process, that will allow a farmer to save a lot on fuel, on fertilizer, and a lot of other things. And to me, that's an excellent example of what's happened. But there were also two surprises on the policy side that I think were important. I said, okay, all civilians can use it, but it's at risk. And then an airplane was shot down by the time the Soviet government over the Kamchatka Peninsula. And our President Reagan said it was a navigation error, apparently. We're going to give a system to the whole world that's going to solve this. And he announced that GPS, henceforth, was to be guaranteed rather than just at risk. Well, at the same time, the military was wiggling the civil signal in such a way that you couldn't achieve accuracies much better than 30 or 40 meters. President Clinton, sometime later, from the Reagan announcement, said, we are no longer going to degrade the signal. The whole world will have undegraded accuracy. So the point is that both on the engineering side and on the policy side, circumstances came together that suddenly enabled a wealth of applications that nobody had really thought of. The vast number of applications that the average man in the street is not aware of. I'm thinking all the way from the farm tractors he or she may or may not know, to the vehicle routing that they do know how to get from hither to yon, but to such things as measuring tectonic plates to millimeters, that's the width of pencil lead, and as a result, having some hope of predicting when earthquakes will occur. All those are being done by GPS /Galileo/GLONASS.
Hugo, I'd like to pick up there. You know, Brad's talking very elegantly about the meeting of the politics side and the engineering side. Just on the engineering, and you may have to slightly put this in lay terms for, given my limited understanding, but can you describe to us a bit about the complexity of the whole system, the complexity of GPS? Because it strikes me that there's virtually no aspect of high-level engineering, scientific thinking that doesn't have some bearing on this. Is it possible to pithily sum up exactly what the complexity is that creates this amazing thing?
Well, one thing that starts right from the beginning is the atomic clock. In other words, the timing of a piece of electronics that can easily get a nanosecond accurate time is then absolutely the center point of GPS. In other words, if you can't measure the speed of light with a gadget, so when the transmitter sends a code, say, from more than 12,000 miles in space to a ground receiver, you have to measure how much time did it take for that signal to get to the ground, to the receiver. And as a result, you have to have something that measures the speed of light. So 1/1,000,000th of a second is a 3-foot error. So you can see that it doesn't take long before you can accumulate enough errors that the whole system is really not feasible. So for me, and getting started in looking at the proposal and then finally being awarded the contract, for me it was always about the clock. And I think that this is the key for us having won this. The other folks that we competed with were building a satellite, a great new satellite. The clock was going to be just, here's where we're going to put a clock in here and we're going to make it do this and that and the other. Well, we had a clock built already to fly by the time we submitted that proposal to Brad. So the complexity was the clock, and we were very fortunate to be America, and everybody wants to come to America because the guy that actually made a large microwave size atomic clock, which would have been impossible to fly, he invented a very small, a few inches, 4 by 4 inches atomic clock, and came to the United States and tried to sell it to Omega Navigation users, which was another ground-based navigation thing that was used by executive jets. He was not good in German. I'm a German. So we began to get married, so to speak, and built one fantastic thing from his initial ideas. We built a space-rated, fully radiation-hardened clock that can last 25 years. Matter of fact, only a year ago, they turned off the last clock that's been operating from one of the initial satellites for 24 years.
Let me elaborate from a slightly different perspective. I agree with everything that Hugo has said. Certainly the clock is a piece of engineering and physics that is at the heart of our satellite, but there are a lot of other complexities. Unknown to most users, all of the signals on GPS broadcast on exactly the same frequency. What a garbled mess. But it turns out they each have their own code, and in your little handheld device, for example, your cell phone, it sorts all that out, and it's listening simultaneously to perhaps two dozen satellites, all in the same hash, and it figures out which satellite is which and then can range to them. But in addition, we need to know precisely where the satellite is. Unprecedented levels of accuracy in predicting down to levels of less than a foot where a satellite is that's 12,000 nautical miles up in the sky. Amazing complexity.
It is remarkable, and I wanted to, hopefully at the risk of embarrassing you gentlemen, read a couple of lines from what the chair of the awarding board, I mentioned that Queen Elizabeth Prize earlier, talking about engineering being this bedrock, a foundation of all civilization, really. And in context of your work, gents, they said, that's what these men have done. They've made things happen. They've rewritten, in a major way, the infrastructure of our world. And that's a pretty staggering testimonial. I wonder what, Hugo, matters most. I mean, presumably this is a fantastic recognition, a validation of so much work, but are you eager to look to the future? I don't know, maybe to the next generation of current students or kids who are out there now who might be in the vanguard of engineering as we look forward. Are you most eager to use these sorts of moments to give a message to them, talk to them about the positive power of what thinking about things in a technical way can do?
Yes, as you are probably aware, of course, that the Queen Elizabeth Prize, basically, the foundation of it, as I understand it, is to encourage the young to choose engineering, because what you said is correct. This, the advancement of the world is going to be coming through engineering in one way or another. And to me, there has to be major programs for the young to choose engineering. For example, during the Apollo days, the engineering assignments and people that wanted to sign up for engineering was very high. It was in the 50s and 60% of all applicants. And when no major program is available, then it seems to be that the liberal arts begin to be the major source. So the Queen Elizabeth Prize is trying to attract these young people and asked us actually to participate in making that happen. And in GPS, there's no limit of what you can engineer, because you can always... Everything that somewhere along the line that you engineer is going to be concerned about exact positions, time, and so on. So I actually think GPS is the heart of all future engineering in one way or another.
Brad, would you go along with that? And perhaps you could share a thought too about, if we take a step back, the role that the great engineers, the real innovators in this space can play as we go forwards. People talk about the shifting nature of economies, the knowledge base, the digitization of the whole planet. But presumably you would identify a genetic code that runs through all of the work you have done and continue to do. And you see that going forwards.
You're raising a massive issue that is very complex, but at the same time easily understood. And that is engineers work in cooperative groups. If you go back to the Roman times and look at some of those aqueducts that still stand 2,000 years later, you have no idea who did it. But I will tell you, it was a group of very competent engineers. In the case of GPS, we had engineers working on software. We had engineers working on how do you predict where a satellite will go. We had a group that were involved in the actual building of receivers. We had launch engineers. It goes on and on. And the point is, somehow engineering comes together, it coalesces into something that is useful, it helps save lives or whatever, and the user generally doesn't have any idea how it happens. It is black magic. And in the case of GPS, I will guarantee you, you touched on complexity. Yes, it is extremely complex. We have to correct for Einstein's general theory of relativity, or your position would be off by miles in a day. So all that happens in that cell phone of yours or anybody else's, and they don't understand how it happens, but they see the result. And the pride an engineer has is not in having his name associated with that, but rather his knowledge that, yes, I made a contribution that was essential to that happening, but so did a lot of others.
That was Bradford Parkinson and Hugo Fruhoff, two of the godfathers of GPS and two of the joint winners of this year's Queen Elizabeth's Prize for Engineering, talking from Stanford University earlier. Tom Edwards was asking the questions. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly. Every year, London dusts off its barrettes, trims its soul patch, and limbers up its tapping foot for its annual jazz festival. We're in the midst of it now, and it continues to the end of next week.
I caught up with director Pelin Opshin to find out more about programming the festival and this year's highlights. Pelin, thank you very much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly. We feel lucky to have you. We've lassoed you in the midst of a very busy weekend, the opening weekend of the London Jazz Festival. How are you feeling? You must have music ringing in your ears, but hopefully in a good way.
It is in a very good way. Very exciting. You know, venues buzzing with people. And it's that time of the year that we are, you know, waiting for, because everything that you work for is tangible in front of your eyes. So it really pays off.
It's the proof of the pudding is happening
it's
right now.
It's the proof of the pudding, exactly.
People will be familiar with, hopefully, with the London Jazz Festival. It's got a long and storied history. We might talk about a bit of that later. But people are used to standing in fields, and that's a festival, right? And everything kind of comes in front of their eyes. But with an urban festival, a city festival like this, you have to be a little bit more hungry. You have to kind of know where you're going. How do you kind of navigate? How do you recommend people navigate the Jazz Festival?
I think the experience in a field festival is different, but not much different in terms of an urban festival could give you like the satisfaction of a treasure hunt,
yeah,
so to say. And it's not just about hunting the right sound, the music for yourself, but the right kind of experience. What kind of venue is best fit for which kind of music? And this artist who is actually playing somewhere in the city sometime, but are they doing something different for the festival, which is the case. So I think the main challenge in a good way is to make sure that the festival differentiates from what's happening throughout the year in London.
Yeah.
And also, can we provide the experience of the right place, right time, and the surprise elements and all sorts of discovery? And does the festival serve as a almost like an advisor for the good music to be found?
Yeah.
So I think the urban festivals, especially in a big city like London, do serve that purpose.
Yeah, you've got that kind of curatorial role as well as a festival. And there's a different way. I like watching gigs as part of a festival because it seems like there's an overarching theme to the presentation of it, or that there's something different rather than just buying tickets and going to see something. How do you kind of describe the atmosphere that you're trying to create at the festival?
I think the festival, because it's London and because it's big and because the audience have all sorts of music appreciations, and we want to make sure that we are covering all angles of jazz, improvisational music, contemporary music, some adventurous genres,
yeah,
as well as some club culture and youth culture. It's a mix of everything, and also some really mainstream and traditional forms of jazz as well. So when you have the, you know, statement of we are doing London Jazz Festival, you can't just ignore some parts of the scene and just have a very niche focused program. We do have focused programs, but it's inside the festival as trails. So we are trying to be as encompassing as possible for all artistic, you know, musical appreciations, which can be built around jazz. But the running theme within the festival are the strands or the themes within themes. So for an arts enthusiast or a design or a lifestyle enthusiast, you can find certain shows which could have cross-discipline elements. For people who are more interested into the UK jazz scene and the buzz around it, they definitely have lots of choices around that. And for more traditional, I will go to a club, see a concert in a very refined, you know, atmosphere kind of an audience. There's
so the kind of supper club kind of vibe
as well.
As well as the kind of down and dirty vibe. And you mentioned the UK jazz scene. and the London jazz scene is very vibrant at the moment. You've come from Istanbul. You were programming the Istanbul Jazz Festival up until the year before last. How do those cities differ in terms of the vibe, in terms of the atmosphere of the jazz scene?
I think,
keep on asking you questions about atmosphere.
Oh, yeah.
Strange, because I feel like it's an atmospheric kind of genre that actually you're watching people, you're close to the action, you're one-on-one with the players.
I think it's a wonderful way to approach it because jazz, the recordings are amazing. What you do in the studio is fabulous and the music itself is very inspiring. But what you see live on stage is something that would never be repeated. Even the same compositions are being played, the improvisation, the interaction between musicians, the surprise elements mm-hmm. that we are integrating in the festival. So I totally agree with you about the experience and the atmosphere. And this is something that you can find only in live elements of the music. In terms of comparing two cities, I think Istanbul was still a very wide open emerging market where we were still eager discovering the first comers, whereas London, you can build up an artist year after year, still build up some audience around them, and there is enough demand, even if we are thinking about the same artist bringing together different projects, etc. So there is, I think, more in terms of taking risks or creating different elements or angles when it comes to London. And you can see it from the festival. It's a huge mashup of different elements, whereas Istanbul was more of, yes, the atmosphere was important. It was open air. It was the Bosphorus. It was fantastic, you know, historical
venues.
You've got
venues. Some certain advantages to the city of Istanbul.
Yeah, I mean, the background.
There's some vibes there.
The background, the vibe, and the underground scene. Yeah. It was really inspiring. But here in London, even if we have four walls around us, it is still really crazy and inspiring as well. But then we also bring in that element of the venue or the different adventurous trails, which, for instance, we are doing a Royal Docks weekender at the end of the festival, the finishing weekend, and we will be using a refrigerator warehouse as a found space, compressor house,
okay,
where
cool.
we will stage steam down. So, you know, these kind of
I can hear the
elements.
Rhythm section tutting and wondering about acoustics. You've obviously checked this out.
We did, but I think that's also the part where the creativity comes in.
Yeah.
In terms of production as well as musicianship. So,
and you mentioned kind of some of the sort of cross-fertility of ideas and jazz music being of an improvisatory nature and a very sort of skillful technical kind of music as well. And you've mentioned how that kind of meshes in with design and different parts. How does that work? How will our listeners be able to kind of dip their toe into something that maybe they're attracted by the jazz festival, but then they go and they end up being part of a different kind of happening? How does that work?
Well, I think all artists, musicians, but mainly jazz musicians, have always been inspired what's happening around them, be it political, be it social, be it other artistic ways of self-expression. And obviously, we do have that, the outcome of that in the festival almost every year. This year, there has been particular anniversaries or movements which we wanted to address. Some artists wanted to respond to these. For instance, we are celebrating the centenary of Bauhaus movement. It is going to be on the 23rd of November on Saturday, the last weekend at the Barbican, where we wanted to approach some artists to ask, what would your response be to this 100 years of functional,
some very mannered
still,
stage sets,
you know,
going on there.
Yeah, but also liberal, egalitarian design, and what would be the music of today mm-hmm. as a response to that architectural or design or artistic movement, which was some sort of an indulgent period at that time. And then we were able to join forces with Erase Tapes, and we invited Dawn of MIDI, Daniel Brand, and then Bauhaus Klang Jazz Ensemble led by Michal Volny to provide their sets or their musical repertoire as a response to the movement. So that is very exciting.
That is what they call a hot ticket.
Right? Yeah, I guess, I hope.
Also, by the way, we should tell our listeners, we have accidentally recreated the atmosphere and heat of a New Orleans jazz club in Studio One here today, just for you, Pelin.
Yeah, because I'm from the Mediterranean and I'm happy
well,
with the seat.
This is normally it's a mild 6 degrees Celsius in here. Today it's a little warmer this on. If you're getting warm, it's fine. Blame it on the aircon. I wanted to ask you about when is a jazz festival not a jazz festival. I know that I mentioned New Orleans, and I was joking, but the New Orleans Jazz Festival has become this crazy thing. The Stones have played it. You've got Iggy Pop playing this year, who's a man of many different parts. Which part is he going to be tapping into for the London Jazz Festival?
Probably it was a very clever move for him and for us as well, because if we wanted to have straight ahead Iggy Pop rock show or the Stooges kind of thing, we know that the London Jazz Festival is not necessarily the right home for it. Whereas he's just released an album, I think beginning of September, Free, where he is, you know, stretching his singer-songwriter and poet type of merits. And we thought EFG London Jazz Festival would be the right platform to provide him the intimacy of a proper jazz gig.
Yeah.
There are certain jazz idiom type of, you know, movements in the album, but I would call it a proper singer-songwriter album. And therefore, we have Iggy Pop. I am kind of notorious of having non-jazz names in the events that I program, and Istanbul was a festival like that. So I'm just hoping I don't leave the impression of, you know, bringing that element.
I think people would be intrigued to see how that goes down. I mean, he's playing one of the larger venues, probably necessarily. Pelin, thank you so much for squeezing us in on a busy Sunday, the opening weekend for the London Jazz Festival. And it runs until the end of the month, doesn't it? 24th of November, I think.
24th of November, full on, interesting venues, concerts, events, dance, film, conversations, anything you can think about around music.
That was Pelin Opcin, and the London Jazz Festival runs across multiple venues in the capital until the 24th of November. And you are still with The Monocle Weekly. Fernando, edition 541 of The Monocle Weekly. It was a pleasure sharing this tropical studio with you and your Matisse cutout shirt.
Thank you very much. Great guests.
Really enjoyed the guests today.
We had the inventors of GPS.
Oh, that's amazing, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. And we couldn't live without GPS today.
Let's thank Fernando, our pals behind the glass today. Today's show was produced by Augustine Macellari, and our studio manager was May Lee Evans.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Robert Bounds. Goodbye.